The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Morris Williams, and it is my great pleasure to welcome all of you to another wonderful event as part of the author series at the Free Library of Philadelphia. The library is the most important part of a life in Philadelphia. And so I'd like to encourage each of us to make a year-end contribution to support programs that are part of the enrichment activities that take place at the library, particularly focusing on our young people and the after-school events that are so important, particularly given the fact that they have missed so much during the past year. Tonight, we are honored to have with us Linda Greenhouse, who has written a fascinating book, Justice on the Brink. Linda is a member of the faculty of the Yale Law School, and she is currently teaching a clinic on the Supreme Court and we've just been chatting about some of the fascinating cases that she and her students have been reviewing. She is a Pulitzer Prize winning author, and I encourage you to read Justice on the Brink because it is both about the personalities of the members of the Supreme Court, as well as various cases that they are dealing with currently. One of the insights, we hear so much about abortion and guns, but Linda makes a fascinating case that religion has become a new focal point for this Supreme Court. And I'm sure that there'll be a number of questions about that because she is being interviewed tonight by Tamla Edwards of ABC Channel 6. And she, of course, has done such a wonderful job both at Channel 6 and also as being a friend of the Free Library with the interviewing that she has done with our various authors. So without further ado, I welcome Linda Greenhouse and I turn it over to Tamla Edwards. Thank you all for joining us. Go Free Library.
Go Free Library, indeed. Morris, thank you. And Linda, welcome. It is an honor to have you here. And looking forward to the next hour. I enjoy Justice on the Brink, and there's so much to dig into. So let's get going. And I wanted to start with why you decided, like, what was the germination of, I want to write this book right now, not in a year or two, but at this moment, in this nascent moment with Amy Coney Barrett, as she's just stepping onto the court versus in a year or two after we've kind of seen the path of some of her rulings.
The year promised to be really so extraordinary because remember the trajectory from Ruth Ginsburg's death in mid-September. By the time Donald Trump went into the Rose Garden and nominated Amy Barrett, Justice Ginsburg had not even been buried. The election was in full swing. There were weeks to go before Election Day, but in many states there was early voting. People were actually voting. And so everything kind of came together. The crazy election period and this sudden death and the norm-breaking nomination. And so it just seemed this was a time, of course, and I had the time during the pandemic, to try to chronicle and put between hard covers what that year was going to be like. So I wrote the book in real time. Each chapter is a month. As I say at the end of the book, I didn't go back to kind of clean up what I said about that month and make myself look smart. It just was as it appeared to me, as it was happening. And so I hope that the book will be, not only something that will inform people's understanding of what's happening right now, but has made a historic record about a very historic sequence of events.
You've watched the court for a very long time. And What was the emotion you felt when you saw that chain of events, that beginning chain of events? Ginsburg dies, Barrett is appointed, she's standing there in the Rose Garden. If you had to pick one emotion to describe as somebody who understands the court so well, what was it?
Shock. I think, you know, we had, remember Bill Clinton, who spent, you know, weeks and months deciding who he wanted to put on the Supreme Court. We had the weirdness of what happened to President Obama after Justice Scalia died and the blockade for, you know, much of a year of that seat, you know, and then all of a sudden, like a whiplash, you know, as I said, I mean, RBG had not even been buried. And we had this announcement. So I was just kind of in a state of shock as a citizen, as well as someone who has chronicled and written about the court for a long time.
And starting with Ginsburg, you know, there had been, and you chronicle it in the book, a long-running debate around her and now around Justice Breyer. Should they have stepped down and made sure that a Democratic president, Obama for Ginsburg, Biden for Breyer, would get an opportunity to name their replacement? In fact, Noah Feldman, which is funny because he's the person saying, don't push Justice Breyer because he will think that it's partisan. But he was writing today about the book that had she stepped down, we wouldn't be here. And I wondered about your thought on that assessment, or is that assumptive? The court can take this crazy trajectory in history and you can say, if she had stepped down, we wouldn't be here, but you really never know.
Well, you never know. I mean, if Scalia hadn't died, if, you know, Mitch McConnell hadn't controlled his caucus, if, you know, I mean, I've done my share of reviewing books. Okay. Somebody once said to me, gave me the rule number one of reviewing a book, and I've tried to take that to heart, which is review the book the author wrote, not the book that you think the author should have written, okay? I did not write a book that blamed Ruth Bader Ginsburg for all the ills that have befallen the country in these last, you know, 4 or 5 years. You know, do I think she should have stepped down? You know, she placed a bet, and she assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to get elected in 2016. You know, put your hand up if you dare, if you were someone who did not have that assumption. And, you know, had she made it for another 4 months, President Joe Biden would have named her successor. So, you know, I'll say that. And then I'll also say that it was during those last years of her tenure, the last, I say 10 years, and the male professoriate started telling her to retire in around 2010, I think, that we saw the notorious RBG, that we saw her using her voice in dissent to call out what she thought was unfortunate about the turn the court had started taking after Sandra O'Connor retired in 2006 and was replaced by Justice Alito. We wouldn't have heard her. And, you know, there's a sense in which we needed her. And so had she taken the, you know, the guy's advice, we wouldn't have had her.
And you made an interesting point that many of us didn't know until the very end how sick she was. We just knew she could do more push-ups than anyone else that you knew, no matter what the age. Yeah. Morris pointed out that you do a great job of giving us portraits of the justices and who they are as we walk into this moment. And so, as I told you, I wanted to sort of go through them a little bit and ask some questions. And I wanted to start with John Roberts, which, you know, you write about his efforts to hold the court, to find majorities and try to move it towards people thinking it's more apolitical. But you note that he's a little by little kind of guy, and that he very much so has a hand in why we're in this conservative moment. And so I thought I'd start with him.
Yeah, you know, there's a great irony to John Roberts' position. So if Hillary Clinton had become president and filled the Scalia vacancy, John Roberts, one might say, would have become irrelevant. And Ruth Ginsburg would have been running the court because there would have been five justices to John Roberts left. Ironically, with the three Trump justices, he threatens to become irrelevant, even though Hillary Clinton didn't win, because there are now five justices to his right. So he's in an incredibly, I'd say almost poignant historical position. His name is on the door. It's the Roberts Court. He's a figure of history. History will judge how well he managed this historic moment. And the more I think about it, the more empathy I have for the position that he's in. He's somebody who is in really masterful control of his public persona. We don't know what he really thinks. He doesn't really share that with us. He's not much of a public figure in that way, although he's one of the most powerful people in the country, or was. It's a fascinating position that he's in.
Is there any precedent? I mean, he can't be the first justice who would have thought herding cats is a better job. Is there anything that they can do, any power he can exert, or really he's just the first among nine and he really doesn't have that much sway?
Well, at the, you know, kind of basic civics level, he's one vote. And, you know, as I say in the book, when Chief Justice Rehnquist died, and Ruth Ginsburg, in her statement, she said, "He was the fairest boss I ever had." I'm sure she meant that ironically, because the Chief Justice is not the boss of anybody. He does, I say he, because we've never had a female Chief Justice. He does have the power to assign opinions if he's in the majority. And that's, you know, that's a not insubstantial power, in that it makes a big difference. Say you're on the conservative side of the court, it makes a big difference whether you give the assignment to Sam Alito, Clarence Thomas, Brett Kavanaugh, and so on. So he can, you know, kind of maneuver at the margins. But when push comes to shove, he really is just one vote.
And in fact, I told you, I think your next book should be about Samuel Alito, who doesn't get as much of the spotlight as maybe some other people do, but it sounds in the book as though he's really the old bull here. And I thought you created an interesting juxtaposition, that Sandra Day O'Connor becomes more moderate over time when she's on the court and seems to have a view for finding the middle. It feels as though his conservatism becomes more muscular and more angry, and we're really starting to see that flare out in public. And I wanted to know more about that and to what degree it influences the younger conservative justices around him.
Ah, that's a really good question. I mean, he does project a kind of anger. And I and a lot of other people I know have always wondered, what is he angry about? He's had a great ride. You know, I mean, he ends up on the U.S. Supreme Court. He's, you know, he's someone to contend with. What is he so angry about? And his challenge, if I were a coach for Sam Alito, I would say, Sam, you know, curb your enthusiasm. You risk overplaying your hand here. I read a coach. Now, Amy Barrett hasn't had the occasion to do much in her time on the court. You know, she hasn't written any major majority opinions and so on and so on. She's written two things that I think are quite suggestive. One was last term in the book, a separate opinion she wrote in the court's big religion case, which had to do with what people here know, the city of Philadelphia, the Fulton case. Alito wrote a very angry, very long opinion saying the court's not going far enough, fast enough. You know, you're wimping out. And she wrote just a couple of paragraphs, and she said, I agree with this outcome, but I don't think we have to go all the way at this point. We need more nuance, not a word that's often heard from the conservative side of the court. So that's data point one. Data point two came less than 2 weeks ago, when the court was asked by 8 healthcare workers in Maine who were seeking a religious exemption from the state's vaccine mandate. They came up to the court. They said, this is a horrible defeat of our religious interests. And they got three votes, only three votes. They got Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas. Gorsuch wrote for the three, but it really had a lot of Alito's voice in there. And Amy Barrett did not join them. She wrote a separate paragraph and she said, I'm not there. I don't think this is the right case. I don't think this is the right move. And we're just gonna let this mandate take effect. And I read both of those, the one in the Fulton case last term and the one the other day, as really saying to Alito, don't take my vote for granted. Sure, we're both conservative, judicially and religiously, but I'm not your girl. I'm gonna go my own way and don't overplay your hand. And I just think it's a fascinating moment that not enough people have noticed actually.
People have been so assumptive about her. That's it, Roe v. Wade is overturned, that we're going to see some very conservative opinions. Those two things, did that sort of make your ears perk up and say, this woman may yet be full of surprises in terms of how she rules and where we're going?
I think so. I mean, I don't take anything about her for granted. I don't take for granted the kind of one-dimensional cartoon figure that she was made out to be by the Democrats when she was nominated. I don't think she's going to undergo a Sandra Day O'Connor, change of her basic ideology. I think it's somewhere in between, and I'm very fascinated to see what that may be. I have the sense that maybe she doesn't know. She's going to take it case by case as it comes. And, be the best Justice Barrett that she can be. Well, personally, I'm going to disagree with her quite a lot, I think. But
I think it's sort of a brave stance that she's willing to say, I want to take my time and to not feel forced to come out of the barrel of the gun. And, we've made it through half of the conservatives. Thomas, you paint as a bit quixotic, that sometimes he goes where you think he will, and other times he pursues kind of his own legal theories. That leaves the other two Trump appointees, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. And you almost can hear the other justices going, what a twerp when it comes to Gorsuch, who seems to love his own thinking. But Kavanaugh was more fascinating to me. You had a line in there that rather than ending up where you know he's going to end up, he almost takes the scenic route to prove he looked at everything. It's almost as if he doesn't trust himself.
Well, I'm not sure it's that so much as he wants the public to think that he's approached everything with an open mind. And, I'm not saying that he hasn't, but after he goes through that exercise of telling us in public, here's what I considered and here's what I thought, he always ends up on the conservative side. So, I think it's a bit of a show that he's treating us to, actually.
Do you think that means he may be open to John Roberts coming to him and saying, and Elena Kagan, who also tries to get them together to say, listen, the public thinks we are partisan. The public thinks that this is a charade in here, and we need you, since you care about what it looks like on the outside, to every now and then come with us out of the conservative majority and stand over here. Do you think he'd be persuaded by that?
Well, I'll say I cannot imagine John Roberts ever engaging in such a colloquy. That's just not how they behave. But no, I mean, look at what happened on September 1st when the court allowed the Texas, what I call the vigilante law, SB 8, to go into effect. The vote was 5-4. It takes five votes to grant a stay. So there were only four who voted to grant a stay, Roberts and the three liberals, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Could have killed Kavanaugh to come over and, give Roberts a little cover and be a fifth vote just to grant a stay. They're not asked to strike down the law, just grant a stay so we can think about it when the formal appeal comes in. No. So from that, I think that was just an extremely telling moment that Kavanaugh could have done one thing and he chose to do the other thing.
let's talk about some of the issues that are facing this court that have been big this year. Let's start with abortion. There are two cases that you point out. You know, one more recently, the Texas case, before that, the Mississippi case. The Texas case, when you listen to the arguments, especially Barrett, they seem to want to talk more about the way the law is applied, this idea of vigilante citizens, less so than abortion itself. Was that your perspective?
Oh, yes. And that's, you know, that's the way it should have been, because the case that the court agreed to decide in the Texas context was not about the right to abortion. It was, do federal courts have jurisdiction, can exercise jurisdiction over this statute that was written to deprive the courts of jurisdiction? So it really was a case about process. Now, of course, it's hard to totally disentangle process from the cutoff of the access to a constitutional right, which is the impact of the law. But the court certainly knows that on December 1st, they're going to hear, you know, that's the main chance to really get their hands on the right itself.
And then there's the Mississippi case. And I warned Linda before we started, I've been through 0 days of law school, so my understandings of cases may not be quite right, but my sensibility, this idea of questioning the attorney general, who you point out is a political figure who seems as though she's gunning to run for governor one day, and her arguments around the line of when abortion is no longer a viable thing, and wanting to, I believe it's 15 weeks, go from the end of the second trimester to 15 weeks. That's interesting to me, because I wondered if you thought that would be a salient argument with the justices, that the science has changed, that what we could do at the time of Roe, what was viable then versus what is viable now, that to me seemed like now there's a door they might go through.
Well, of course, the fact is the science hasn't changed, and it's essentially the same as it was in 1973 when the court decided Roe, in 1992 in Planned Parenthood against Casey, another case from Philadelphia, from Pennsylvania, where the court upheld the right to abortion. So the notion that science has changed is totally phony. But I'll say this. So ever since Roe, almost 50 years ago, the court has maintained that before fetal viability, which is 23, 24 weeks, woman has an absolute right to choose to terminate the pregnancy. You can make the woman crawl through all kinds of hoops and stand on her head and, you know, recite all kinds of stuff, but at the end of the day, it's her choice before fetal viability. The 15-week ban in Mississippi is designed to challenge that, to test that. And viability has been the firewall that has protected the right to abortion. If you breach that firewall, there's no obvious reason why you wouldn't go down to 10 weeks or 6 weeks like in Texas, or 0 weeks. That I think is a law that is either pending or about to pass in Arkansas. So if they breach that firewall, if they uphold the 15-week ban, in my opinion, the right to abortion is gone.
And you probably know this better than I do. Is there an argument that somebody would make? Because you see people say all the time, the baby was born early and the hospital managed to keep him alive. And look at him now, he's 6'3". I don't know, is that, do we have any of those cases before what's judged to be viability? Or all those cases have generally been babies born after that 7, 8, 9 month mark? Do you happen to know?
Well, certainly there's never been a viable fetus at 15 weeks. That's not possible.
No, I meant more like when you get to like 23, 24.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are, I mean, that's deemed to be the mark of viability. So, I mean, there are extremely premature babies at maybe 22 weeks of pregnancy, you know, who with good medical care, you know, CHOP or whatever, you know, can survive, although many of them survive with substantial impairments.
But nothing that substantially changes the science or changes what we know.
Nothing has changed the science. I mean, if, you know, eventually maybe there'll be an artificial womb or something like that, but that's all science fiction at this point.
And I'm sure everybody watching this is wondering, whether or not you think between these two cases, we are going to see an overturning or a substantial changing in what has been precedent here.
Oh, I think so. I mean, whether Roe is overturned explicitly or simply functionally because of what I said about the viability firewall, sure, because they had no other reason to take the Mississippi case. In the Mississippi ban, basically all the red states have passed laws like this in one way or another. And all the federal courts have declared those laws unconstitutional, as the federal courts did in this case, because on the face of it, they are unconstitutional if you assume the constitutional interpretation of the right to abortion is what it has been for almost 50 years. So in other words, there was no conflict among the lower courts, and that's the major reason why the Supreme Court will take a case. If there's an important issue that the lower courts disagree about, the court will step in and say, well, we need a national rule. The rule has, you know, the law has to mean the same thing in Pennsylvania as it means in California. That wasn't the case here. There was no conflict, but they took it anyway. And as I chronicle in the book, they took it after months of mysterious discussion about it that never became public, but week after week after week, they would meet about it to just, you know, waiting to decide whether to take this case, which they finally did in May. So very deliberately decided to take it. And there's only one reason to take it, which is to think that it's time to change the law.
I wanted to ask you about gun rights, which is obviously a big deal in Philadelphia. We are closing in on 500 murders in this city. And there's always a push. I know you can't, it's a shocking number. And of course, there have been efforts to try to have gun control, which always fail in front of the law. So that's one that a lot of people here are watching. And it seemed to me as though Thomas and Alito in particular, and Gorsuch as well, they really want to get their hands on a gun rights case and substantially expand our understanding of Second Amendment rights.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the court has turned down almost every case since 2008, when the court decided the Heller case and for the first time said the Second Amendment gives an individual a right to keep a gun at home for self-defense. And every case that the court has turned down since then, Thomas or Alito or more recently Gorsuch has said, we're turning the Second Amendment into a second-class right and we need to change that. And they finally got their case. And I think one way or another, the Second Amendment will be interpreted. The question in this case is, what are the requirements? How restrictive can the state be about granting licenses for concealed carry outside the home? And New York has quite a restrictive law, one of the more restrictive in the country. And I think that law is not going to survive this examination by the court.
You know, I think a lot of us look at Texas, where it feels as though they want to give a kid a rattle and a gun at the rate they're going. And do you think ultimately we're going to see an expansion where more states than not under these court's rulings, there's going to be a lot more people walking around with guns?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the argument went to, well, you know, assuming we allow more concealed carry, are there places where it can be limited within the meaning of the Second Amendment? How about campuses? One question was, how about the subway and all this kind of thing? And, you know, the court is really opening a can of worms if it goes that route, because is the court going to become the de facto, you know, gun license issuer for the country in specifying it can be here but not there? And I don't know, they seem to be willing to go down that road, and then, you know, the country is going to have to live with that.
I wanted you to talk a little bit about your observation of where we're going after this last year on religion, because if I got it right, we started with religion can be treated no worse than any other law, that now it's religion should be treated as well as the best, and we may be headed towards religion as its own thing, treated better than anything else. That if I just say I'm doing X, Y, and Z because of a religious holding, I have opened up a new set of rights. Am I reading that correctly? Where are we going here?
oh, you are reading it correctly. And in fact, one of the major things that happened in this past term happened right after Amy Barrett came on the court, within her first week or two. Before she came on the court, when Ruth Ginsburg was still alive, the court during the pandemic had had a couple of these cases challenging the capacity limitations that various jurisdictions had put on, you know, where people could gather, how many people could gather for this reason, for that reason, for religious worship. And churches had challenged, saying, you know, you're limiting us to X and we really need X plus, you know, 100 or whatever in our sanctuary. And the court had rejected these claims by votes of 5-4, the Chief Justice writing that, you know, in a public health emergency, we judges should defer to the public health experts, right? Hardly seems like rocket science. Anyway, the first one of these cases that came up after Justice Barrett was there, from, it was a case from New York, the court flipped and it was 5-4 the other way. And the capacity limitation was held to violate the right to free exercise. So that was just a, I'd say, a straw in the wind. It was more important than that. And we went on from there, more explicit cases, the Philadelphia case that where the court struck down the ability of Philadelphia to require that its social service contractors honor the non-discrimination principle in the city ordinance and in the contract. And there's a big school case coming up, going to be argued next month, about whether states are obliged to provide the same kind of tuition assistance to attend a parochial school that they do to attend a secular school. That's a major, major breach in precedent that's about to occur. So religion is where a lot of the kind of cultural and political pressures are playing out right now, and the court is a full participant in that.
I'm sure you've been thinking about this. How does it change us? How does it change us as a country? You know, most school children can tell you separation of church and state. They may not know what it means, but they've heard it. What happens if our fundamental understanding of religion and how it's treated in this country drastically changes?
Well, we've had a series of Republican presidents who have named a series of conservative Catholic justices to the court. And, you know, even to say that raises people's eyebrows, because I think religion is the last taboo in our society. You know, you can talk about people's sexuality, people's gender identity, all kinds of things, but you can't talk about their religion. But nonetheless, it's a fact that there's a majority of Catholics on the court, of conservative Catholics on the court. As to why that is, my view, and not everybody, I don't expect everybody to agree with me, but my view is that Republican presidents who are pledged by the Republican National Platform to pick justices and judges who would overturn the right to abortion, you can't say to a potential nominee, hey, by the way, how are you going to vote on Roe against Wade? But instead you name a conservative Catholic as a proxy for the question that you can't ask, and indeed that the nominee would not be able to answer. So we're left with a court, a majority of which is extremely attentive to religious claims above other kinds of claims for non-discrimination, for the right to contraception, for, we've seen a series of these cases, and it's just going to go on. And I think it's a very important social problem right now, actually.
We've got three more liberal justices, Justice Breyer, who's now the senior liberal jurist, Justice Kagan, and Justice Sotomayor. And there's a marked difference between Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor in style. Kagan, a former law school dean, seems to try to figure out, is there anywhere where we can come together and find some places around the edges where we can agree? And Sotomayor, you say she's following in the footsteps of RBG and exercising what you call demisprudence. I'm not sure if I said that correctly, yes. Where she knows, you know, I'm not going to win, but I am laying down a marker for history and speaking in a full-throated way. Which of those two do you think is more effective in terms of both within the court and within with the public?
Well, that's an interesting question. Which is more effective? I think we need the Sotomayor's voice to kind of call out what's happening, as she did in the series, really shocking series of federal executions that the Trump administration carried out in its last 7 months. And I think we need an Elena Kagan who is using her really great abilities to work with legal materials. And I think she has had some success over time in not changing bottom line outcomes, but in succeeding in modulating the path the court takes to get to those outcomes. And sometimes the analysis the court uses is just as important as the bottom line, because what matters is going to be the next case and the case after that and the case after that. So I would hate to be put in a position that you're trying to put me in, of picking the one over the other. I'm glad that in this very conservative era of Supreme Court history, we have them both.
You know, one thing I hadn't realized until I read your book was the impact of the pandemic on the court. That there's in between when we see them publicly listening to arguments, their conferences, their private lunches, you know, there's a lot of back and forth and interplay between them, which of course went away when we all had to be socially distanced. They did a lot of things by the telephone. What do you, as you judge it looking back on this year, what has been the impact of not being able to have a more personal touch with each other?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure, and I'm always very wary about, you know, pretending to know more than I know. But I do know that, as you said, I mean, the normal pattern at the court, they make eye contact, you know, on the bench 3 days a week out of 2 weeks out of every month from October through April. They have their private conferences twice a week. They have lunch together the days the court's on the bench. And so, although I don't think they engage in a lot of sort of off the bench chatter about cases, for instance, their rule at lunch is we don't talk cases. Somehow being together just has to have made a difference. I think it would have made a difference back in the fall, a year ago, as all the election cases started coming up. The ones before the actual election day were very contentious inside the court. We saw very angry dissenting opinions from Justice Alito when the court didn't take the Republican challenges that were coming up to the different ways that states had amended because of the pandemic, amended access to the polls. I somehow think if they'd been able to look each other in the eye, they could have lowered the temperature there. And maybe had they lowered the temperature before the election, it wouldn't have given the impression that the court was available to Donald Trump after the election. The court, of course, proved not to be available. So that might have made a difference there, but I'm not 100% sure.
I was surprised by something you said, Clarence Thomas said, when asked about, because people are saying, are you guys at each other's throats? And he said, you know, I can't think of a time when anybody has raised their voice in conference, which I couldn't imagine when you are, there's so many momentous major issues with such different viewpoints. Do you think that's really the truth, that they're able to, without rancor, without yelling, discuss these things?
Yes, actually, I do think so. I wouldn't say necessarily without rancor, but certainly without yelling. I mean, they're all, you know, they're all grown up in the sense that they realize that they're never going to be able to get anything done unless you get four people to go along with you. So it's not like, say, in the House of Representatives, where there's this caucus and that caucus, and, you know, maybe you're not speaking to them or whatever. You can't live like that in the Supreme Court. So I think they have learned. I think every justice learns to be pretty well behaved. And I think they have developed norms to protect that the quality of the interpersonal relationship. I mean, that's why, you know, we don't talk cases at lunch.
Right.
No talking shop. We don't barge into somebody else's chambers to kind of, you know, feel them out or schmooze them or whatever. The interaction among the justices really happens on good old fashioned way, paper. They write memos, and the memos are circulated among the nine chambers. And all of that is designed to channel the very strong feelings that, of course, they have about certain matters, so that they can maintain a kind of a, you know, civility, even if deep down inside they're really angry about something.
We've gotten in about 10 questions, and I think we've got about 15, 20 minutes. So I'm going to see if we can get through them so everybody gets to jump in here. The first one is, we talk so much about how the Republican agenda led by Senator McConnell has changed the political landscape in reference to the court, but to what extent do Democrats need to take ownership of the role they played in leading to the court's politicization? Thinking specifically of the Bork nomination in the 80s, is there a way back in your opinion, or is the court forever doomed to be a deeply partisan institution? Now that is a mouthful, Linda.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of mythology about the Bork nomination and what happened, but what people maybe don't remember is that he was defeated by a strong bipartisan vote. That was not a partisan vote. You know, and the Barrett confirmation was actually the first time, I think in American history, or maybe only once before, that a Supreme Court justice was confirmed with no votes from the minority party. So the Bork battle, I could spend the rest of our time together talking about it, but people have to realize it was a much more complicated event than the mythology has come down. So, but the question is, should the Democrats take ownership of the politicization of the court? You know, actually, I'm going to push back on that. So Bill Clinton had two nominees, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer. They were both confirmed by overwhelming majorities. I think there were only two or three dissenting votes, you know, like 97-3. In both cases. And why was that? It's because President Clinton, who early in his term had a, you know, a strong grip on the Senate, played to the middle. I mean, he didn't take somebody who was known for their left-wing ideology, shall we say. It's really the Republicans who've tried to use the power to put somebody on the court to advance an agenda that they had failed to advance through normal political means. Now that's a harsh judgment, but I'll stand behind that.
And it kind of leads to this one. Why do you think the right has been so successful at motivating their base around Supreme Court nominations, but the left has failed to bring their voters together? You know, you talk a lot about the Federalist Society, which has been around for decades now, and we see the fruits of their labor. And you wonder, is there as muscular a progressive organization in terms of coming up with jurists for the future? And why not?
Yeah, I mean, the observation is totally accurate. I mean, there is a progressive version of the Federalist Society, but it doesn't have the money or the clout. You know, the conservatives have played a long game in part because what they want from the courts, they can't get through normal politics. Whereas Democrats have had a much broader political agenda and haven't seen the courts as advancing that agenda more than trying to get legislation through. I mean, just look at what recently has been happening in Congress, where, you know, the $1 trillion package hardly got any Republican votes. I mean, why is that? The Democrats had a legislative agenda, and the Republicans have an agenda too, which is stop anything the Democrats want. So they turn to the courts, and they've been both strategic and lucky. It takes luck also. They've gotten the vacancies at the right time when they've had power, or the power to stop as with the Scalia vacancy, which was extremely important in motivating the base. And, you know, that's how we've gotten to where we are.
A question about your own habits. How do you organize your research to call up exactly the background or quotes that you want?
I print out a lot of things. I like paper in my hands. I file a lot of things. I have lots of file drawers and filing cabinets. And, you know, with luck, I can remember that I have something and I can find it. But it's a challenge. I don't have a research assistant or anything like that. So, yeah.
That's amazing. I am so impressed that you did this all yourself. How do you view the Roberts Court on the activism scale, say, for example, in relation to the Warren Court, which is famous for being a more activist court?
Well, I kind of would put them in the same category, actually. I mean, what's funny is that, you know, of course, conservatives have been decrying judicial activism for as long as I've been around. And now we see the same thing on the right, although they tend to call it judicial engagement, not judicial activism. But what one means by that, I think, is using the courts and the judicial process as an engine of change, an engine of progress, an engine of change. And that's what the Warren Court did. And I think, you know, the other side of the coin is that's what's happening in our federal courts now.
Okay. Does public opinion have any effect on how the court may rule, regardless of personal conviction? Do the conservative justice truly want to be on the record as taking established rights away? How would overruling Roe v. Wade impact other judicial precedents? And that's a question that I had. You noted in the book, I think you said 2/3 of the public stands behind Roe. What happens if the court finds itself going in a direction that is out of step so severely with the public?
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem for the court. This was a problem during the Warren Court years because the Warren Court, you know, stood for desegregation, stood for getting organized prayer out of the schools, stood for major increased protections for criminal defendants. And a large segment of the public didn't like any of those things. And so there was a backlash, and Richard Nixon ran a very successful presidential campaign in 1968, running against the Warren Court. And, you know, with all kinds of dog whistles, you know, he couldn't say race, and so he said crime and that kind of thing. And, you know, if the public is really upset with what comes out of the current court, there will be a backlash in our politics, but it could take a long time. It could take, you know, like with life tenure and so on, it's not something that's going to happen overnight.
You know, it's so interesting when you talk about the Warren Court, because now we look at a lot of the things they did and they're lauded, and we forget that at the time, it was not an easy place to stand.
No, I mean, there were, I've written a book that deals with some of this. You know, there were yard signs all over the South, impeach Earl Warren. You know, we don't see signs today, impeach John Roberts. So we're kind of beyond that. But yeah, there'll be, if the court does overturn or functionally overturn Roe, there'll be, I'm sure, a major political backlash.
Do you think RBG is looking down from wherever she is and regrets that she didn't retire earlier? I think you kind of got into this at the start.
Yeah.
My guess is she's focused on what's going on where she is.
Yeah, right. Where they still need all the help they can get.
Let's see. They'd like to ask you for perspective about the court across your long career. Have things ever been this bad before, or is there reason for optimism? And I will note, it was an honor and a joy to interview Justice Sotomayor a few years ago, and I was struck by her optimism, which was based in belief in America and in the Constitution, that she thought that what was right would always prevail.
Yeah, that's great. You know, things ever been this, quote, bad before? I mean, I'm sure they have. And I think there is a built-in corrective mechanism. I think a lot of our problems do not begin and end with the U.S. Supreme Court. It certainly do not begin and end with the fact that Ruth Ginsburg chose not to retire. Some people seem to think that, you know, that's the root of all of our evils today. So, you know, I think our problems are caused by politics, and they're going to have to be solved by politics.
Is there any hope to ever overturn Citizens United? What would have to occur? Which, I mean, why don't you explain for people who don't know? I mean, that it was such a substantial ruling in terms of money in our politics.
Yeah, so Citizens United, which was in 2010, I think, it was a First Amendment ruling that got rid of limits on the amounts that corporations could spend in politics. Will Citizens United ever be overruled? Not by the current court, certainly. And I'm not sure that as things have evolved, that it's had the kind of cataclysmically negative impact, standing alone as an opinion, as a decision of the court, that people thought it would, because the way things have developed online and different ways of conveying political messaging, you know, I think certainly Democrats have held their own in fundraising. It hasn't been a huge advantage, I don't think, to Republicans. So I think we've kind of moved on from, you know, the notion that Citizens United was going to totally wreck our politics. There's lots of other threats to our politics, deeper than that, at least in my opinion as a citizen.
You know, often, and I think Gorsuch in the book a couple of times says, you know, this is not the role of this court. What you want is for Congress to do. Congress to do its job and legislate and follow through. And I'm thinking about voting rights. We've seen the voting rights, the John Lewis Act can't get out of the House and definitely won't make it past the Senate. And they don't seem to be getting much ground. And then when you look at the court on that issue, John Roberts, if we want to stop discriminating by race, we need to stop discriminating by race. The ruling in the Arizona case, they just seem to be picking apart our understanding of voting rights. Is there any redress on an issue like this? Or do we essentially find that he can say that the legislature should do something, but the American public is going to find itself with no redoubt to go to?
Yeah, that's extremely serious. You know, I'm not smart enough to know how we get our way out of the cul-de-sac that we're in, kind of a vice of politics have given us a judiciary that does not seem responsive, as in the Arizona voting rights decision that came down at the end of this last term that I write about in the book, responsive to the basic aspect of democracy, which is that everybody can vote. Extremely serious problem with you know, the gerrymandering of the House, just a part of it, which of course the Supreme Court has also refused to address. So there is a kind of a synchrony between our political lockup and the political branch and the lockup in the judiciary, and it's a serious problem.
You're getting a couple of questions about court packing. Joe Biden has said, you know, you guys, somebody will study it, but he doesn't seem open to expand the number of jurists beyond nine. Do you have a personal opinion on whether or not to do that?
I don't really. I've tried to keep myself agnostic on it. I get the argument, but it's really at this point, it's no more than a thought experiment, because it can't happen with our current Congress. So, you know, it's just not going to happen.
You know, you've talked about the fact that Trump seemed to think that having three nominees was his ace up the sleeve, and it didn't work out the way that he thought. Someone asked, with such a polarized court, are there concerns re Trumpism in the future? How can the justice system be protected if rules can potentially be bent at will? Is that something you're thinking about? If we saw a second Trump term, if he was able to get justices on the court who were really, 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 really more in line with his philosophies and super right thinking, where the court might end up?
That's a nice thought, isn't it? I think that had the court done what Trump wanted it to do and basically became a tool of invalidating the 2020 election, the court would have destroyed itself as an institution. So, you know, if the same thing repeated itself in 2024 under the scenario that you just described, makes me shudder to think about it. So let's not think about it.
Okay. We're coming to the end of our time here, and you've written many books about the court. You've spent 30 years covering it. You probably have many more columns and books to go. And I just wonder what usually pops in your mind as you think back over not just your vocation, your avocation. You clearly do this because you love this and you're fascinated by it. When you look back over your career covering the court, what most of all comes to mind about this institution?
You know, on one level, it's mystery, it's power. The ultimate question of, you know, why do we do what it tells us to do? A mystery that goes way back to the founding. You know, when I went there every day for almost 30 years, you know, I never felt jaded about walking into that building. I respect it and I hope for the best for it. So in the questions that have come up here about, you know, the possibilities for doing great damage to the country, it makes me, you know, worried and sad, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it's played a very important role in my professional and personal life.
Well, Linda, it has been an honor to spend some time with you this hour. As most people who are tuning in, when I see your name on a piece in the New York Times, I go, I got to read this one. And so thank you for the book and thank you for your career.
Well, thank you for such a good interview and good luck to you too.
All right. All the best.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.